I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Shortly before killing 20 people and wounding more than two dozen at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas, the alleged shooter posted a hate-filled message on an online message board. He reportedly used white supremacist language aimed at immigrants and Latinos, railing against a, quote, Hispanic invasion, and saying he opposed race mixing. The mass shooting is being investigated as an act of domestic terrorism. Last month, FBI Director Christopher Wray spoke to members of Congress about the increase in homegrown domestic terrorism.
In terms of number of arrests, we have, through the third quarter of this fiscal year, had about, give or take, 100 arrests in the international terrorism side, which includes the homegrown violent extremism.
This year.
But we've also had just about the same number, again, don't quote me to the exact digit, on the domestic terrorism side. And I will say that a majority of the domestic terrorism cases that we've investigated are motivated by some version of what you might call white supremacist violence, but it includes other things as well.
Our guest, Vegas Tenold, began talking with members of some of these well-known white nationalist groups a few years back to understand their appeal and their political ideology. He was embedded with them through the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville 2 years ago, where protesters shouted racist and anti-Semitic chants and where a young woman was killed. He wrote about what he found in a book that came out last year, Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Vegas Tenold, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. What is the appeal of these white nationalist groups?
Almost the same as the appeal of any group. I think fundamentally it's about belonging to something that is bigger than yourself. I'm painting with a large brush here, but many of the members who seek out these kind of groups are feeling left behind in various ways, or disenfranchised, or just angry. And this sense of belonging gives them purpose. You know, it's better to be involved in a epic battle for the future of your race than just being somewhat of a loser, I would say. So I think fundamentally it's about fellowship.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. You talk about angry. What are they so angry about?
Oh, that is a tough one. And I think that's also an ever-changing thing. But I think mostly it's just this vague sense of unease. The white supremacist movement in America has seen a lot of changes, and a big shift was obviously the civil rights era, where they kind of went from fighting to maintain power to fighting to regain some of the power they seem to have lost. But this iteration of white nationalists we're seeing today, it's just this vague sense of that things used to be better for white men like them. Things that, you know, they would have it more easy, and now there are things you can't say, there are things you can't do, and there's political correctness, and all this sort of culminates in this vague idea that something is terribly wrong, and it's hard to put their finger on, and I think that's almost even making them angrier.
You know, I'm thinking about the Charlottesville rally, which was almost 2 years ago, I believe 2 years ago this weekend, with protesters there chanting, you know, Jews will not replace us. And I'm interested in this whole sort of replacement idea, why that resonates so much with these groups.
I mean, no one likes the idea of being replaced, right? But I think to these people, it's a theory that has been, again, it's been around for decades, but it's been gathering steam a lot lately. This French writer called Camus wrote a book called The Great Replacement, which has been hugely influential to these people. And I think they have discovered that it's a good rallying cry for international white supremacy. It's not just here in America they fear that the white race will somehow be replaced, but in Europe. So it's a way to sort of build solidarity, I think, across borders. And it's something that will appeal to a lot of people. Again, as I say, not a lot of people like the idea of being replaced, and the white nationalists can take that fear and mold it into something they can use.
And I'm assuming because America, like other countries, is becoming more racially and ethnically diverse, and that whites will become a minority party, or excuse me, minority people, in some years hence.
Yeah, and I mean, look, to you and me, and to hopefully most other people, that doesn't seem that terrifying.
No.
I mean, a multicultural society seems to me to be a better society. But to these people, progress is very much a zero-sum game. And to them, if one group is to gain rights, then another group has to lose rights. So they see it as white people losing out to the benefit of others.
You know, about 100 years ago, the KKK had a rally in the streets of Washington, D.C. They marched through the streets. And I'm thinking about that, but also thinking about the role that the Internet seems to play today. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about this new iteration, again, of white nationalism, you know, we sometimes call it the alt-right, which implies that there's something new about their ideology. And you know, there really isn't. It's the same old ideological garbage that's been around for decades. What is new, as you say, is the Internet. And the Internet has had a huge effect in building this movement. A lot of people who aren't comfortable being public have been able to get involved in a scene. It has also, you know, it's also taken its toll. It's pretty much broken the back of the groups that that need to meet to exist. But you see, it's opened up brand new avenues of radicalization, and I believe that it is largely to blame in the increase of acts of terror that we've seen. It's created an atmosphere of one-upmanship. It's the previous one feeds the next one, and I think that the Internet is very much to blame for that.
Has it also created a kind of lone wolves, as they're called, that we've seen Dylann Roof, I'm thinking of others who, and perhaps the El Paso shooter, we don't know yet, but allowed sort of lone wolves to be radicalized but not be part of a group per se?
Sure, I think so, and I think it's forced us to reassess what we mean when we say lone wolf, because now with the Internet, there is no such thing as a person just sort of being radicalized all on his or her own. You don't need to meet in person, but you're sort of drinking from the same trough as everyone else. So even though you're technically alone in your room while you're radicalizing, you are very much part of a community. I think a lot of the acts of terror that we've seen before, going back to McVeigh, a lot of them have been somewhat of lone wolf actors, because groups in general don't like to get involved in violent acts, or there's always going to be some member or some leader that says, let's not do this. These days, if a person would approach a far-right extremist group and say, let's go bomb something, the assumption would be that he is an undercover informant and that it's a very bad idea to follow on that impulse. But I think these acts of violence in general, not just now with the Internet, but in general, have tended to come from people acting on their own. But again, the Internet just makes this so much easier and more convenient for would-be terrorists.
Vegas, are they happy we're talking about them?
I think they are. You know, there's this thing that you shouldn't talk about the name of the terrorists, and I very much think that's true. And you should be careful about how we talk about them.
Sure.
We shouldn't, you know, necessarily talk about their manifests or spread their message or spread the ways in which they're using to spread their message. But yeah, I mean, they believe in notoriety. 8chan recently changed their slogan to embrace infamy. So I think, yes, absolutely, this is very much part of their strategy.
You profiled a number of groups in your book and a number of leaders of groups in your book, including Jeff Shep, I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, he who headed up the National Socialist Movement. He's quoted, I'm looking at the New York Times, he was quoted in the Times saying, I was joining something to save my country, to save my race, to save my people. Now I feel like that talk and some of that hate is coming to a head where it's more violent, more pronounced, and people are doing terrible things. Explain to us, does that make sense to you as you have spent time with him, understanding his ideology and his thinking about things like violence?
I mean, I think there's a level of self-delusion in there, because the ideas that the white supremacist, that the far right has for the society isn't, they aren't political ideas. They're inherently revolutionary, radical ideas that necessitate violence to come about. You know, Jeff Scoop has told me endless of times, you know, that he would like a white America, that he would like a white ethnostate. And he's not stupid enough not to realize that in order to bring that about, there needs to be violence. I think there is a level of plausible deniability that the leaders of the far right like to maintain. Richard Spencer, Matthew Heimbach, after Charlottesville, a lot of them were coming out and saying, you know, this is a tragedy with Heather Heyer. We certainly didn't advocate violence. And, you know, in a way they didn't. But the far right has always been driven by this dynamic of plausible deniability from the leaders and then just excessive mayhem and violence from the membership. So this is kind of how things work. It is an inherently violent ideology. And just because not all the leaders espouse violence all the time, doesn't mean that they aren't fully aware of what their ideology really means.
Should we think of terrorists? These are terrorist groups, then?
I mean, in a way, it makes sense. I mean, they're radical, they're revolutionary groups who espouse violence in one way or another, and violence with political aims is, you know, per definition, terror. Yeah. So, sure, yeah.
You talk about this idea of plausible deniability. Are they afraid of things like lawsuits?
Oh yeah, they're deathly afraid of lawsuits, and the lawsuits in the wake of Charlottesville really has done a number on the movement. They're afraid of lawsuits. They're afraid of going to prison. They're afraid of all the things that most people would be afraid of. And for the leaders, it is oftentimes their necks on the chopping block. So they would absolutely like to keep a distance from their most violent members. But at the same time, if you want to build membership, if you want to build a sense of urgency, then you need to portray your struggle as a revolutionary end times battle. And by extension, there is a fair amount of violence and blood and chaos within that.
Almost, I'm going to break here. You said end times struggle, sort of seeing that this is really the possibility of the end of life as we know it.
A lot of them see it that way, yeah. For the most, you know, the most extreme on the far right, the skinheads, they're always talking about Rahowa, which is short for racial holy war, and they're seeing it as very much an end times battle, a clash of civilizations kind of thing. But they've seen it this way for 50 years now, so just because any given Nazi on any given day sees himself as part of an end-time struggle doesn't mean that's correct. But again, it needs to be, the battle needs to be that dramatic. It needs to be that stark in order to get people on board, in order to get them to think that I'm not a loser. I have purpose. I'm fighting for my blood. I'm fighting for my heritage or for my predecessor. So you really need to, you know,
Vegas, we got to, yeah, sorry to do this. We got to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Vegas Tenold. And a couple of years ago, he embedded with a number of white nationalist groups, the Nationalist Socialist Movement, the KKK, the Traditionalist Workers Party, among others, wrote a book about it called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Vegas, how do these groups look at each other? Do they think they're all on the same team, or are they in some sense competitors with each other?
I like to compare it to, and this gets a little bit nerdy, but maybe your listeners are aware of the movie Life of Brian by Monty Python.
Absolutely.
And there are these factions who all fight for sort of Palestinian self-determination, but they hate each other. It's the Palestinians' Liberation Front and the Liberation Front of Palestine. And it's all these, and it's very much the same thing on the far right. There's all these extremely large egos who cannot for the life of them get along with each other. There is all this ideological minutiae, religious aspect. So no, that's been one of the problems that have bedeviled the movement basically forever, that they really cannot get along with each other and figure out a common set of goals and how to go about achieving them.
Is that just because they're disorganized or there's something about their personalities? They don't get along with other people no matter who they are?
I think it's a little bit of everything. And look, a lot of these groups are fundamentally different. The KKK is a Protestant Christian organization. The skinheads and the Nazis are absolutely not religious at all. The Traditionalist Workers Party, who I followed, were Russian Orthodox. Richard Spencer believes that people should be able to have abortions. So, mm-hmm. So there are all these. You know, it's much like any other political movement. You know, we're seeing it on the left as well now. You know, how do you build a voting coalition that will include the voters of Michigan and Pennsylvania with the people in Brooklyn? So I think it's much the same dynamic, only on the far right, they're also stupider and less organized and more prone to anger and infighting. And they have weapons and they like to fight. So it's hard to get anything going.
Should we think of them as stupid?
I don't think we should. Well, I think we do it at our own peril. And I was being somewhat facetious when right. I said that. But no, I don't think we should think of them as stupid. I think we should think of them as not a very cohesive movement. I think we should think of them as a dangerous movement and a violent movement. But I don't think we should belittle or ridicule them, because we need to take them seriously.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Paul. He says, President Trump could do an enormous amount to put an end to the current violence just by asking his followers to stop doing it. I'm curious about when you were embedded with these groups, if they talked about Donald Trump, maybe candidate Trump or President Trump, how they talked about him, or if they even did, and how they viewed him or view him.
Sure. Yeah, so I mean, there was a big shift when Donald Trump came on the scene in 2015, 2016. I was at CPAC, I remember, when he had his first speech there with one of these leaders, Matthew Heimbach. He'd snuck in, and he kept snickering and laughing and throughout Trump's speech and calling him a joke and all these things. But then, you know, as candidate Trump realized that the gains that could be made from sort of playing on white grievances and white fears, then the far right movement also discovered that, you know, he was perhaps not one of them, but he had sympathetic ideas and he was the best they can get. And this turned into sort of somewhat, to a lot of them, a full-throated support that lasted for, you know, a little while after the election, but it was soon. They were pretty soon disappointed when the realities of governing came in, and he didn't build the wall immediately, and he didn't ban all the Muslims immediately. But, you know, that's the point. As I say, this is a revolutionary radical movement, so they're never, ever, ever going to be happy with any political outcome. So as much as they want to support a politician, they can never support this political system, because it is a system built on compromise, and that's just not the world they want.
So if we think about revolution, is it them taking to the streets, or somehow inspiring people to take to the streets so that we will fight this out, you know, hand to fist and gun to sword?
I think they have different ideas of what the revolution looks like, and I think that's an argument and a debate that's taking place on the far right right now. You know, do we do what these guys in El Paso and in Pittsburgh and in Christchurch do? Like, is this a revolution with weapons, or do we try to sneak in the back door? Do we train our people to be law enforcement officers and military and doctors and lawyers and politicians? You know, I think both sides are gaining ground now with their own people, but I don't think we really know what the revolution will look like. But you know, at the end of the day, that is what they want.
Do you think it's coming?
I hope not. I think that's up to us, to a large degree, to be able to mobilize and to be able to formulate a protest and to be able to resist these people. I mean, they're loud and they're scary and they're dangerous and they cause a lot of mayhem. But, you know, all of us have the power to organize against them.
John had a question. I'm reading here on the screen. How are we supposed to combat white supremacy?
we combat white supremacy by, again, by organizing, by protesting. There was a large protest planned a while ago in Portland, but anti-fascist activists organized and they showed up, and the far right didn't. And I think we need to understand what anti-fascist organizing looks like. We need to understand that Antifa isn't a scary, violent bloc, but actually a loose group of community organizations that get together and organize. I think we need to get educated. I think we all need to realize that we have a part to play in this.
A question from Chip. What does your guest think about commentators like Ben Shapiro and Tucker Carlson, and he says, and their role in promoting white nationalism? Do you see it that way?
I see Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and those people as the first line of just the assault of white nationalism and white supremacy in this country. I mean, I think Tucker Carlson is extremely dangerous. He's been saying invasion. He's been talking about infestation. He's been using the words of white supremacy far more than Trump has, and I think it is really dangerous what those guys and what they're doing.
In reading your book, and your book came out about a year ago, but you seem to also be saying that these groups are vying for Russia's affection. Did I read that right?
At that time, they very much were. There was all these rumors that Russia were doling out money to far right movements, and you know, there was some truth to that, not necessarily that they were giving out money, but they were certainly trying to influence the American system, the American electoral system. But back then, they all believed, based on a few loans that Russian intermediaries had given to nationalist movements in Europe, they all believed that if they found the right Russian, they could somehow establish a link to Putin and then get a bunch of money. I don't think that was true at the time, but that's what that they believe. But, you know, in a larger scale, Russia is the shining city on a hill to these people. Russia is a country that has succumbed to nationalism in a way that the West still hasn't. Russia is a place where Putin has embraced traditional values for very pragmatic reasons, but he's embraced the church. He's embraced this idea of Russia, Russian nativity. So I think they look at Russia as aspirational.
Just a couple more questions before we have to say goodbye. I've interviewed Christian Piccolini, Frank Meek. Both of them were, Frank Meek was a skinhead, no longer. Christian Piccolini was a member of a white supremacist group. Both of them are now sort of working to convince often young men to turn away from these kinds of groups. Do you see them as important and effective people who can address this problem because they have been there?
Absolutely. I mean, they understand the rage that these kids feel. I mean, I think to a lot of us, when we look at skinheads and when we look at Klansmen, we see something entirely foreign. Mm-hmm. It is something confusing and baffling to us. But so I think that's why there is a real benefit to having these people who have been through it and who can speak to them on a personal level. I think that's not the only way we should be combating this, obviously, and I think Christian will agree with me. I mean, I think we need to get at the roots of radicalization. Mm-hmm. But I think to have these voices who have been through it, who have lived that life, is absolutely, it's incredibly important.
Let me read from the very end of your book. You write, "Ultimately, I believe that the far right in America, at least the incarnation I spent years covering, is destined to fail, not because America is inherently good and that the forces of justice and progress are always stronger than those of intolerance and hatred, but because white supremacy is doing just fine without the far right." What did you mean by that?
Well, America is a country that is built on the notion of white supremacy from its very foundation, and throughout after the slave era, white supremacy has found a way to remain in power through Jim Crow laws, through the war on drugs, policing, imprisonment. America is still, for all its progress, an extremely racist country systemically, and it's difficult for all of us to break out of that system of racism. Even those of us who would very much like to find that we are living in a racist system that it's hard to get to the heart of. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, which is a hugely gentrified area. I live in New York, which is a liberal bastion, but it's still one of the most segregated, unequal cities in America. So I think if we're going to move on, we have to look at ourselves and say we are part of a racist society, and America is fundamentally a racist country. And I think we need to try to acknowledge that before we can move on.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Vegas Tenhold, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Myself as well. And he has covered the far right in this country for a number of years, wrote a book last year called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. Well, the dead in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, are being mourned and buried after two horrifying mass shootings over the weekend. Dozens more who were injured, some of them seriously, have a long road ahead, both physically and psychologically. When we talk about gun violence, the survivors and their families are often forgotten in that conversation. Our guest Helen Ubinas and her Philadelphia Inquirer colleague David Gamacorta wrote a moving and heartbreaking article last year, Shot and Forgotten, about what they called the hidden toll of gun violence. Helen has also been on the front lines covering the gun violence crisis in this city. Last year, there were 353 homicides, and so far this year, there have been 6 mass shootings in Philadelphia, leaving 2 dead and 30 injured. Helen Ubinas, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just ask you just your thoughts.
Sure.
I mean, last weekend was just a horror. I think many people feel raw. They feel angry. They feel frustrated. They feel frightened. I'm curious what you're thinking and feeling these days.
All of the above. Overall, because I've covered gun violence in the city for so long, I'm sort of once again in this spot where, you know, we're having these conversations, and it's hopeful that we're having these conversations. But, you know, you have to wonder why we're having the kind of conversations we're having right now. And it speaks to whose lives we value, whose deaths we value, whose voices we value, and I think that's where we're at now. And while I think it's incredibly hopeful that people are naming things for what they are, meaning racism and mass shootings and white nationalism and white supremacy, it has to be said that for a very long time, people, journalists of color, academics of color, communities of color have been calling these things out, and they've gone mostly unheard. And I think that if we're going to be having a conversation that's going to lead anywhere, we have to acknowledge that. And I think it's, I'm optimistic that right now, let's be honest, mostly, you know, white male pundits are calling this out, but they're calling it out after years of people who frankly look like me and talk like me and are from communities like me have been calling this out for a very long time. So when we're speaking about whose lives matter, we also have to talk about whose message matters and what messenger matters. And that has to be part of this conversation.
We wanted to have you come in because as horrifying as these mass shootings are, we live in a city where there is gun violence almost every day, does not get the same kind of coverage, including 6, by definition, mass shootings in Philadelphia so far this year. Does that tell us that urban violence is just something that we expect and is normalized and we don't respond the same kind of way?
I think it tells us that that's something that some people expect, that unfortunately people in positions of power to change the narrative have come to expect and normalize. And I think it speaks to something that I'm incredibly passionate about, that I've written a lot about. In addition to gun violence, I write a lot about diversity in our newsrooms, right? I write a lot about inclusion and representation and taking our public mission very seriously, which means that you serve the public. And what I think, you know, I think we have to own our part in this. And I think we're having these really delayed conversations about things that we should have been talking about for a very long time, because people in these positions who should have been leading these conversations, you know, at all of our institutions, whether they be locally or nationally, just were not having it because, let's be honest, they just weren't that important to them.
You're talking about coverage. We're talking about this because of coverage. And you're also saying that if you don't have a diverse newsroom, you're not going to get the same kind of stories.
If you're not representing your public, then there's no way to echo the public's concerns and to echo their stories and to elevate their narratives. And that's where I think we are right now. And I think as responsible, passionate journalists, that conversation is just as needed as the other conversations we're having right now of calling things what they are, whether it be, you know, the president being racist or white supremacy or white nationalism. I think that conversation has to happen right now. And honestly, and I've also said this in my columns, we have to go beyond the conversations. We have had conversations for years. I've been in the business for a very long time. It's time for action. And if there's, you know, inaction, then we're going to continue to find ourselves in a place where we're not having the necessary conversations that are important to people of color in this city and in this country. People who look like me, people who I love, people who, you know, I care about, are afraid. And they've been afraid for a very long time. You know, black and brown people in this country were afraid way before the El Paso shooting, and they're going to be afraid for a very long time.
We're almost up on a break here. When you say action, what do you mean?
I mean, I can speak as a journalist, right? And so this is an incredibly important topic to me, to make sure that when we do pay attention to the mass shootings, as we should, we pay attention to the shootings that also matter in the city that I happen to be living in other cities. And that's what it means, to make sure we elevate that.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you and also give out the phone number and ways that you can join our conversation. That's Helen Ubinas, and she's a Philadelphia Inquirer columnist. She covers a lot going on in the city, including a lot of the violent crime in the city, the gun violence in the city. As I mentioned in my introduction, she and her colleague David Gemmacorta wrote a really heartbreaking but also sort of heartwarming story last November called Shot and Forgotten, about what they call the hidden toll of gun violence. And these are, of course, the many survivors of gun violence and what happens to them, frankly, when the press goes away. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoe, talking with Helen Ubinas, and she is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Let me quote something. This was in the Washington Post today. It's headlined, Hispanics in America Are Under Attack. And it's written by a number of leaders of organizations and political leaders as well. One of the things they say here is, so let's call Saturday's heinous act of violence what it is, a carefully calculated and purposeful hate crime targeted at the Hispanic and immigrant community. It is an act of domestic terrorism. This is, of course, El Paso. Many will not want to hear or believe this. Hispanics in this country are under attack. Black and brown people in this country are under attack. Immigrants in this country are under attack. I quote that because you said that before we hit the break.
Right.
Feeling that way yourself.
Right. I absolutely feel that way. And I think others feel the same way. And I think, you know, sort of to bring it back locally, which are issues that, you know, any chance I get, I want to make sure that we're talking about this. But, you know, we have to care as much about black and brown people feeling under attack in their own neighborhoods as we do in Philadelphia, as we do black and brown people feeling under attack, whether it be a movie theater or a concert or wherever. And I think that we are still failing on that front.
Why?
I think it speaks to,
because it's over there versus here.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, for a lot of people, unless it really, you bring it home, it intimately, personally affects them, it's just somebody else's problem. And I've said this for years. When I gather people at the museum steps and I say, like, you know, this is the impact.
This is the Philadelphia Art Museum.
Yes. Every single Philadelphian is impacted by gun violence in one way or the other. And we continue to feel comfortable in convincing ourselves that that is not the case.
Let me talk about this Shot and Forgotten series. And
sure.
As I mentioned, it's really moving. You're profiling a number of people who are the victims or the survivors of gun violence. One guy named Jaleel Frazier. Tell us about him.
So Jaleel Frazier was or is a young father who was shot and paralyzed when he protected three kids during a robbery at a barbershop. And I first met him months after he was shot, when he was still very much struggling with his new reality. He was living in his living room in North Philadelphia.
In a row house, right?
In a row house, because, you know, there was, as anyone who knows anything about a row house, you can't access very much, even on your best day. And so he was struggling with, you know, what his life looked like after. And I've chronicled his journey ever since, to the point of one of the things that often came up when I spoke to Jalil and other people who were in the same situation was just the struggle to find services, basic services. And, you know, there is sort of, you know, so there are some organizations here and there. There's no sort of, you know, clearinghouse universal sort of spot where you go to, you know, this place to help you with whatever you need. And one of the things that kept coming up was that there was a lack of support. And so he found support online as he searched for other individuals who were paralyzed gunshot victims. He came to the last gathering at the art museum steps, and he and I ended up being the last people there because there was a huge thunderstorm that thankfully hit at the last minute. So he and I under a tree, and we're talking while his wife ran to get the car. And he once again brought up that he really yearns for that support, being able to reach out to people. And it was
so isolating.
It's incredibly isolating, you know, because to many people, it's a you live or you die. And if, you know, you live, people move, we move on with our lives, not realizing that individuals are still in such dire straits and dire needs. And I, you know, I had looked for a group like this for him and other people who needed it and could not find one. And if they exist, they're doing an incredible job of, you know, remaining anonymous. So I promised him that day, if I can't, I'll look again. If I can't find something that really speaks to you and other people in your situation, I will help you. I will help you create it. And that's what I did with the help of Temple University, Scott Charles, I think you know really well,
yep.
And Victoria Wiley, whose brother was shot and who is very, very committed to this cause. And so last month, we had the first meeting where a handful of paralyzed gunshot victims got together. And it was, I've covered this issue for a very, very long time. I've covered really heartbreaking and heart-wrenching and heartwarming stories, but I remember just sort of standing there and watching them just sort of like close the circle and talk to
literally,
each other. Yes, right? And bond with each other and try to help each other. And, you know, as a journalist, you get into this business because you want to sort of make some sort of difference. And you hope that you make some sort of difference. And you want to use your platform to empower others. And this is a moment where I thought, you know, all right. Like, this is good. This is good for them. And I'm going to do whatever I can to hopefully continue it. They have another meeting. I believe it's August 18th or 19th. I'll put that on my Twitter to make sure. But this support is needed. And what I realized then is that the survivors, the people most impacted, are the ones who are mostly doing the work. And we have to sort of pay attention to that.
Well, and we think of all the people who have died because of gun violence, and you multiply that by the numbers of people who have been injured. I mean,
right.
Some of them grievously, like Jalil,
right.
Who's now paralyzed in a wheelchair. But there's also the family. I mean,
right.
The family who then is left to care for their mm-hmm. loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, certainly in some of the people that you covered in a city like Philadelphia, they have to fend for themselves,
They do. And moms and wives and girlfriends often have to put their lives on hold to care for their loved ones, you know, in the most basic of ways, where these services should be available and they should be able to access them in really easy ways. And as David Gamacorda and I found, that just is not the case.
There were several people you profiled, and I just wanted mm-hmm. to sort of catch up with them. One is a little boy, 6-year-old, named Ralph Brooks,
right.
Who you profiled. And, you know, he's a young kid, so he was going through wheelchairs mm-hmm. and going through all the prosthetic devices because he's a young, active kid.
Right. I think, as we said in the piece, in a lot of ways, he was the first survivor victim that I think in Philadelphia we sort of paid attention to. You know, this was before my time here, but we were like, oh my God, this happens. This is what's happening. And unfortunately, you know, as the years and the number of survivors and victims have increased, we've lost sight of that. That people just don't live or die, but they sort of find themselves in situations where they need our help. And, you know, we need to do a better job.
There's also a young man, Azir Harris,
right.
Who shot 5 times, paralyzed. His dad, a chef at University of Pennsylvania.
Azeer, I really hoped that Azeer would make it to the meeting that we had last month, because I think that he would gain a lot. I hope he comes to the next one. He, as you said, is, you know, a young teenager, sort of in the prime of his life. His friends are sort of moving on with their lives, you know? I mean, as young people do, they have lives to live. And he's in a position where his, you know, he has a loving mother and father and family who are trapped. That's the only word I can sort of use. Trapped in their home because they are unable to find a wheelchair accessible home that could accommodate the rather large family. You know, and the options last time I checked were, well, we can separate the family in different units. And, you know, part of me is like, okay, well, that's a quick fix. But, you know, this is a family that wants to remain together and that needs each other more than ever. And once again, we are failing a victim of gun violence that we as a city have failed to deal with in any meaningful way.
Is there a part of city government whose job it is to address the problems of survivors of gun violence?
Well, you know, I was on your show not that long ago talking about the Office of Violence Prevention, and I've been incredibly vocal about my concerns about the office, including the concern I had the other day when I was, you know, online and I saw a job pop up and they're hiring a $65,000 communications manager, which, you know, I have concerns about because, as I've mentioned, you know, we have three people in that office, you know, with rather hefty paychecks. And I'm not slamming them. They all, you know, they have impressive resumes. But honestly, when I walk the streets, I'm not seeing a sort of meaningful change in people's lives to really validate yet another paycheck. And when I questioned it, the city spokesperson was incredibly eloquent. And, you know, I get it. You know, we need to have better communications with the community. We need to have more outreach. There are a lot of people in the city who get paid for outreach. So what I want to happen is for people who are living in Philadelphia to see marked improvement of their lives, you know, to see people really care about the quality of their lives.
And you're saying that too many people do not feel that way.
I'm absolutely saying that. And I think, you know, perhaps this communications manager will also know that. Or, you know, I'd be happy to sort of take this person out and just tell them, you know, that people in this community are doing the work. You know, there's often this narrative, the community isn't doing their part. They are absolutely doing their part. The people who are not doing their part in Philadelphia are those who are paid to do their part, lawmakers and leaders, whether it's in the government or in institutions that should be doing better.
What should they do? And actually, an email from Thomas saying, given the weekend horrors and the daily tragedies that your guest covers, what will it take to control gun violence?
You know, that's a great question. If I had that answer, I think
I think we're all trying to struggle
huge.
Through
we're
that.
We're all trying to sort of find, you know, find a spot to sort of like make change. How can we change? How can we make life better? You know, as a journalist, that is making sure I'm elevating these stories for however long I have this platform to fight for the, you know, the inclusion and representation of the public that we serve so that we're not taking forever to name things for what they are, which is terrorism, domestic terrorism in our neighborhoods, white supremacy, racism. It's taking us too long as a country, as a city, to name things for what they are. And what happens is our communities are the ones, the people who are really, truly losing. You know, because it's not theoretical to them. It's not theoretical to me. It is personal.
I remember doing a show a couple of years ago when there was a pilot program called Focus Deterrence. And the idea is that you focus on the individuals who were more likely to be either the perpetrators or even the victims of gun violence. And you do a kind of a combination of carrots and sticks and try to really address that. And I think they carved out a part of Philadelphia. And according to, I think it's Temple University, they said their shootings were reduced by 35%. Mm-hmm. The money went away. The attention went away, and now apparently it's coming back.
Right.
But I think that's kind of emblematic of something that got tried.
Right.
Looked like it worked pretty well, certainly worth investigating, and then it sort of evaporates, and then we reinvent it.
Right. It's about what we prioritize. It's about the commitments that we make. And these can't be fly-by-night commitments or temporary commitments. You know, gun violence is our reality. And I'm not just talking about Philadelphia. I'm talking about our country. And until that changes in a marked way for a very long time, I think we have to continue to make a commitment to, in big ways, small ways, to do something about the gun violence that's affecting all of our lives.
What do you think is at the root of the kind of gun violence that we see, though, in Philadelphia itself? It's a poor city, for one.
Yeah, I don't think there's one easy answer. I think it's systemic. I think it goes back decades, years. I mean, it just goes back for a very long time. There's a lot of reasons. There's a lot of despair in our city. There's a lot of poverty. There's a lot of anger. It's interesting to me that we're talking so much about mental illness and anger and trauma when we're talking about the young white men who are committing these acts of terror. But we don't have those conversations mm-hmm. about the young black men who are both perpetrators and victims. And you have to wonder. I mean, I don't wonder. I know what the reason is. But you have to wonder, why are we not having those conversations? Why are we so quick when it's a young white male committing these atrocities to really dig in there and try to understand their mindset? And when it's a young black or Hispanic male, what we're doing is, as fast as we can, throwing them into prison or programs without any real help. And not just them, I might add, but also their families. We have families. We are a city who is suffering from major trauma because of unchecked atrocities that we, or many people, have chosen to view as normal. Hmm. And part of that is how we sort of even, we call this everyday violence. And I have been guilty of calling it that. I'm no longer calling it that. That we should be offended by that. This is not normal, and it has to stop.
There's a program, we've had them on from Drexel University, the hurt people, essentially uh-huh. hurt people. I mean, yep. healing hurt people. The idea that you have to look at the trauma because the trauma has all these consequences, some intended, some unintended.
Right. It was interesting. Your guest had mentioned, earlier guests had mentioned something about folks who had been, white supremacists reaching out to the young people who were angry and all that. And I think that that's very important, to have individuals in the communities who found themselves in these situations, both sides of the situations, to reach out to young men and women who are at the cusp of, I don't see opportunity. I don't see a way out. I don't see, no one's listening to me. And again, to not to belabor the point, but I find it fascinating how we are so open to having that conversation when we're talking about young white supremacists or folks, young white men who are committing these atrocities. We have to have these conversations about our young black and brown men mm-hmm. in Philadelphia and in cities across this country.
Almost out of time here. Oftentimes those people are called interrupters. Is that what you mean?
Uh-huh.
Someone who's sort of the community and can talk to yes. young people yes. about their lives,
yes.
the choices that they
yes.
have.
And I think that's important, but I would be remiss, not bringing this up again. I think we have to still, the one thing that we are failing at doing is assessing what works and what doesn't. The Office of Violence Prevention has been around for a while now. As I said, we're hiring somebody new, community outreach, and we still have not adequately assess what works and what doesn't while we're still sort of funding programs. That is a mistake. And I will say that so there's no breath left in my lungs. That's a mistake. And we have to fix that now.
We're going to end on that note. Helen Obenius, thanks for coming in. Once again, joining us on Radio Times, and she's a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, covers a fair amount of the violence in the city, the gun violence in the city as well. And again, wrote a really long and moving article with her colleague, David Gemmacorda, called Shot and Forgotten, about the survivors of gun violence. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.